Hi, this is Nancy Clare. Welcome to Speaking of Mysteries. About 3 years ago, I was asked to review a book by a first-time suspense writer for the newspaper we both used to work for. I was very familiar with the writer's byline as a globe-trotting investigative reporter and looked forward to the assignment. Well, triple-crossing. This week's guest's Sebastian Rotella's first novel was a revelation in more ways than one. First and foremost, it was a crackerjack story featuring a young Border Patrol agent named Valentin Pescatore, assigned to the line, as the border between San Diego and Tijuana is known. Pescatore was a unique yet very American character. He was from Chicago, the son of an Italian immigrant via Argentina who spoke Spanish, and a Mexican mother who did not. When he got to San Diego, his accents in both Spanish and English were ridiculed. After being lent to another law enforcement agency, he traveled to the triple crossing of the book's title, the lawless frontier region where Brazil, Argentina, and Paraguay converge, and that was the book's next revelation. The triple border, a place where drug kingpins, arms dealers, and jihadists find common ground and cultivate joint business pursuits, which seems like it must be a fictional plot point invention, actually exists. The story was compelling, and the end, with its true-to-life ambiguity, was extremely satisfying. But you know how it is. When you meet a great character, you want to visit with him again. Fortunately, Sebastian Rotella has brought Valentin Pescatore back in his latest novel, The Convert's Song. Valentin, no longer a Border Patrol agent, has moved to Buenos Aires and gone to work for someone he met in Triple Crossing. But he's still on the right side of the law. His boyhood friend, Raymond, however, who comes back into Valentin's life in a too timely-to-be-coincidental way, is not. Here is Sebastian Rotella. Hi, this is Nancy Clare, and welcome to Speaking of Mysteries. Today's guest is Sebastian Rotella, whose second novel, The Convert Song, is being released on Tuesday, December 9th. And before we get started, I want to congratulate you, Sebastian. The Convert Song has been chosen as one of Amazon's best books of the month in mystery, thriller, and suspense. And you are in very good company with Lisa Scordellini, Haruko Murakami, Thomas Perry, and Val McDermott, among others. To me, the choice makes perfect sense, but you must be thrilled.
Oh, I'm very happy. It was a very nice piece of news as the publication approaches, and I'm very excited about it, and you're right, it's privileged company.
The Convert Song is the second in what I can only hope will be an ongoing series of suspense novels featuring Valentin Pescatore. Am I pronouncing that right?
Perfectly.
But before we delve into the book itself, I have to ask, you're a much lauded investigative reporter now with ProPublica. What prompted, compelled, drove you to write crime fiction novels?
You know, I mean, I always wanted to write novels and write books in general. And, you know, and the good fortune I've had with the work I've done as a foreign correspondent, investigative reporter, is that I've gotten to know these worlds that interest me so well, you know, overseas and in the States, the worlds of law enforcement and intelligence and immigration and terrorism and sort of international intrigue. So I had plenty of sort of knowledge and material that, as much as I enjoyed exploring it in journalism, I really wanted to explore it more in depth and at length, in which with the liberty and authority that you get from writing fiction. So it was just, you know, it just sort of built up over a while, and obviously it was hard to do, and it's still hard to do because I do work hard at my day job, so to speak. But it's been a lot of fun and really exhilarating now that this is my third book. I wrote a nonfiction book and my second novel, so I'm starting to feel like I'm making progress.
Well, you mentioned your day job, and your day job is all about getting verifiable facts. Is it hard to switch gears and make it all up, even if some of the premises of your books are based on reality?
Well, it's kind of the best combination, you know, because I mean, I write as much as possible. It's very grounded in experiences and observation and cases and characters and real life, all kinds of real life details, big and small. But there is still, you know, that ability not to worry about confirming every last, you know, piece of information or, you know, writing around the things you weren't quite able to get. So it's actually a lot of fun. But what's interesting, it is a little bit still, I mean, I still do feel the rigor in that I'd like to think that, you know, most of what I write is realistic. That doesn't mean all of it happened, or certainly that I'm, you know, I'm not taking journalists, newspaper stories and changing the names and presenting them as fiction. It's much more complex than that, and it's much more sort of a mining of all kinds of experience and knowledge. But I do feel like it has to ring true, you know, and I sort of apply that test to it as I'm writing. So I feel that most of it meets that test.
Before you started writing suspense novels, were you a fan of crime fiction? And who were your influences?
You know, I mean, as a kid, I really liked, the classics, Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett. I also liked Eric Ambler, the British spine novelist, who I read. I then later discovered Le Carré, but I, you know, before him, Ambler was one of the, you know, and you remember sometimes that the books you read first, they aren't always the best, but, you know, that you read early in your sort of your reading life that have a lasting impact. So I certainly like those. And more recently, certainly Mike Connolly, my friend and great former LA Times reporter and great crime novelist, George Pelicanos, I like. Le Carré, as I said. And then there's some novelists I like a lot who aren't really crime novelists, but sort of explore territory that converges. I like Richard Price, Robert Stone, and Tom Wolfe would be three that come to mind, you know, that explore realistic worlds, often worlds of, in the case of Stone, often, you know, stories that happen overseas or stories about law enforcement in the city, and in the case of Richard Price and Stone, and that use what I think is great about crime fiction, or that kind of literature that at least follows the form of that's close to crime fiction, is that it's entertaining, but, you know, it works at another level too in terms of, I think, it really has a literary aspect, and that's what I try for.
The Convert Song takes up Valentine Piscatore's story about 3 years after we met him in Triple Crossing. Triple Crossing was a surprise in many ways, but one of the key revelations is that, just as in politics, crime makes for strange bedfellows, that mutual convenience seems to overcome ideological divides. Even a scorecard won't help in identifying the bad guys from the really bad guys. Tell me, are we suspending disbelief in your books, or is this really the case in the underworld where just plain crime and terrorism intersect to dangerous ends?
No, I think that is very realistic, and you know what I experience wherever I go, whether it's Latin America, where, as you said, I spend a lot of time, and where those kinds of convergences you describe happen in dizzying ways. You know, I mean, I first started covering Islamic terrorism in South America, which was very interesting, you know, to see, now that I've covered it in the Middle East and in Europe, you know, to see it sort of in that manifestation through a Latin lens. And, you know, the globalization has meant the globalization of crime, and it's all about alliances and jumping across borders, and, you know, and if there's anything, you know, you see repeatedly in important, you know, major cases of whether it's organized crime like drug smuggling or arms smuggling, or cases of Islamic terrorism, you know, that are international in scope, you see all kinds of remarkable connections, all kinds of unexpected alliances and mixes of culture and language and background. So, I mean, I think that's very much grows out of what I've seen and experienced.
This is about your first book, your first novel, I should say, Triple Crossing, but mm-hmm. I'll never forget your description of the triple border of Brazil, Argentina, and Paraguay, where you had, you know, Jews that are working for the United States, trading quips with Middle Easterners who are raising money for jihadist camps, and all of whom are working with the Chinese. It just...
quite frankly, scared the pants off of me because I really hadn't thought of that before.
It's interesting. I remember, I mean, you describe it very vividly and very accurately. And, it, you know, those kinds of mixes exist in a lot of places. What happens in a place like the Triple Border, it's kind of, it because it is kind of this frontier town where the gangsterism is almost out in the open, you see it in the most stark relief. And because it's almost like this gigantic market, you know, with all these different, all those different combinations and mixes and ethnicities and languages going on, you're right, it's at its most stunning. And I, as much as I had seen, you know, and I spent a lot of time, say, at the Mexican border where you see that kind of thing in other places, it is one of the most remarkable places. But there are places like that around the world, you know what I mean? And what's interesting is places like that are much closer to each other than they would seem in terms of geography, you know what I mean? Because one of the things that the scope and the power of international criminal organizations does is kind of erase distance and erase borders.
It's almost as if they didn't exist in reality, they'd have to be invented. You know, I know that someone referred to your Triple Border as like in Star Wars, the Los Isos bar scene, where it's just everybody and everything, and a polyglot of languages and cultures, and you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend kind of approach. Or the guy with the biggest pocketbook is my friend.
And everything is a negotiation, and everything is a transaction, you know. And the people who survive, and, you know, and again, it's, and there's so much lawlessness that the ideas such as right and wrong and upholding the law and pursuing justice become very distorted and contorted. And the people who have to operate in that milieu have to make all kinds of choices, you know. And that's one of the things I really like with my character Pescatore and some of the other characters I explore and the situations I put them in, is having to navigate sort of that kind of terrain, you know, and on a moral and ethical sense too.
Right. It's moral relativism. Let's go back to the Convert song. Good stories always seem to have an underlying theme, and for want of a better word. And in the Convert song seems to be about the vagaries of friendship and the ties we have to our past that can't be severed no matter what. Is that the case with the story of two boys who grew up to be on opposite sides of the moral divide between Valentine and Raymond?
Yes, I mean, and it certainly has that archetypal quality, which I like, and, you know, I like old gangster films and like Angels with Dirty Faces, and that's part of it. And I think also because it's just a reality, and wherever I go, I see that too. You often see that happen at places like, I don't know, in the streets of Chicago where I'm from, or at the Mexican border where, you know, people grow up with similar roots, and one goes in one direction and one goes in the other. And I think what you described as the theme of it is true. The other word I would add is identity, right? In other words, your past as the roots of your identity, and how all of us are kind of constructing and reconstructing identity. And I think that both these characters, these two friends, one who's become, ended up on the right side of the law, and the other have grappled with this. You know, they're both come from sort of mixed background, ethnic backgrounds, and are very agile border crossers in that sense, in terms of being able to speak different languages and function in different cultures, which is a strength but also vulnerability, because they can move among different tribes, but they don't necessarily belong to one of them, you know, so that creates a certain solitude, and their bond kind of, they're from childhood, grows out of that. So yeah, I mean, that to me was, you know, whatever else happens in terms of the crime and the plot and the intrigue, that's very much at the heart of it, and I really sort of see that as the sort of the heart of the book.
Well, you open with the backstory of the relationship between them, and after Valentine and Raymond have a run-in with the law, Valentine's father gets him out of Chicago, which sets him on another path, and Raymond continues on his duplicitous course. Do you think Valentine dodged a metaphorical bullet by being placed on another path by his father?
Yeah, I mean, I think, and that was what I, when I introduced the character in Triple Crossing, you know, when he's a young Border Patrol agent. I mean, there's a certain amount of people I met when I covered the Border Patrol and other police departments, young men who, you know, who come from, you know, tough working class neighborhoods, and there often isn't you know, there were certain choices or certain moments that decided whether they went in the direction they went or on the wrong side of the law. And so I think he did. And if you remember, the border, you know, overwhelmed him because he was basically a decent, proud cop, but also with great sympathy for the migrants and sort of overwhelmed by the whirlwind of lawlessness that he sees and the temptation that's there too. And so in this book, he's a little older, a little wiser, a little more focused, but he still has that wild side and that attraction to the outlaw side, which then, you know, is embodied by the return of this friend from his past, Raymond, and that kind of dark side that he thought he had left behind.
So let's move away from the darkly psychological and into the melodic. Many writers use music to set a scene. You mentioned Michael Connelly, and he uses jazz selections to give us insight into Harry Bosch's emotional state. And Joe Nesbø, who's actually is a rock star in Norway, also includes songs to suggest atmosphere, especially in his Harry Hole novels. But you take it a step further. Each chapter of the Converse song is a song title, and the songs range from Sinatra standards to French gangster rap. And considering the book's title and that Raymond was a singer of considerable talent, do you think that music was an organizing factor to the structure of the book?
It really was, and on different levels. I mean, number one, I like music. I listen to music when I write. I listen to it when I think. I have my family on my mother's side. We're all professional musicians in Spain. So music is, you know, a very important part of my life. And as I was thinking about this book, this character, Raymond, as you said, he's a singer and he's a con man. And he is very much grows out of, you know, is inspired by a number of real life characters I've seen in that world of crime and terrorism and intelligence and police people who function as informants and gangsters and are always survive because they sort of systematically seduce and betray people, right? So and in this case can also recruit people and sort of radicalize them to become terrorists. And I thought that it would be an interesting metaphor to have someone like that actually be a singer and have sort of a literal siren song. You know, I thought that would be interesting. I also thought it would be a talent that made him appealing and sort of embodied his very real charm, because he does have a charm, and people like that do tend to be charming. I thought, especially because he's a character who isn't either long stretches in the book when he isn't physically present, but a lot of the plot of the book is trying to figure out who he is and what he's doing. The music and the songs are a way of manifesting his presence, right? And then the other thing I think they, you know, and this sense also of melancholy and longing and loss, you know, of the past, because ultimately I think music, you know, for a lot of us represents a certain period, you know, so what Pescatore is thinking about his old friend, and oftentimes, you know, the past is defined by songs of a certain time or a certain style, a certain era in your life. And the other thing the songs do, you know, because the book moves around and tries to explore different subcultures and places, I had fun, you know, as you said, having French rap when we visit the housing projects of Paris or the tango in Buenos Aires or, you know, or even unexpected combinations like a French cop who listens to the blues. And it's not, you know, it's not mechanical. It's not like each chapter, you know, is about a song, but a song appears in one way or the other. Sometimes we hear it. Sometimes it just suggests the theme. But that was a lot of fun, and it was kind of a device that sort of came to me, and it just sort of grew on its own. You know, sometimes you're not completely in control of what you're doing as a writer, I found.
I hear writers say that all the time. And
I bet you do.
but I've encountered a bit of that myself. But it's the fun of it, you know. It's the fun of those characters. And what struck me about Valentin is he really is a romantic. He is a... you know, his relationship with Isabel went one direction, and he talks about that in the book, so we won't have a spoiler. But he's looking to be invested in a relationship that will give him an emotional home, or so it seems to me. Is that true?
I think you're exactly right, and that's part of what, and that's sort of on the romantic side. You know, part of that what I was talking about earlier, this profound solitude that comes, you know, and the choices you make in it, and it extends also to this rather idealistic traditional sense of love and romance, you know, and this guy who's who's looking, you know, to connect with one way or another, whether it's with a place or a profession or an individual, or you know, or and so absolutely, I think that is very much what he's like, and I think, you know, I mean, he's a character again who sort of grows with me as a writer, but one of the things that I like about him is sort of trying to develop aspects of his personality like that.
Well, he's you know, now he meets a French woman, and that's another aspect of his cross-border sort of cosmopolitan relationship, and but that brings me to the next question, which is, you know, what's next for Valentin, and is there another book in the series hopefully coming soon?
Yes, I mean, you know, each one inspires me to keep going, and you know, it's funny, when I had a conversation with Mike Connolly recently, he said he'd made the mistake of his wonderful Harry Bosch character starting him out at 42. Well, luckily I was, without realizing it, I was smart, and Valentin was 25 when I started with him, and now he's about 30. So there's plenty of time to grow with him, and absolutely. I see another book with him. I might bring back one of the protagonists, the Mexican journalist slash cop protagonist from the first book, Mendez, but Pescatore is going to continue for a while because I'm very comfortable with the character, and I really enjoy writing him. And I want to keep, I mean, my idea is to keep, not to an extent that's crazy, but to keep moving him around the world, you know, because I think part of, like, there's this rootless, restless quality, you know, and the kind of work he does, you know, takes him to different places and in different directions. So, and now, you know, that he's left the Border Patrol and has this job as an international private investigator, that helps me, because I like this idea of the investigation also as a voyage, or as a journey, as a quest, you know, and I tried to do that in this book, and I can see, and I did it in Triple Crossing to some extent too, and I definitely want to repeat it again in the next book.
So there is a next book. So I've at least extracted that from you.
No, there is. I'm not being coy. I definitely see another book with him, and as I said, probably with Mendez, and more in the world of probably a return to the world, not of the Mexican border necessarily, but of immigrant smuggling and immigration, and also frankly something that is more of a challenge for me to write about, but that I find interesting, which is the world of sort of white collar crime in the States. So one of the things I've grown fascinated about in recent years is, you know, I spent all this time around the world writing about, you know, the Latin American cartels and desperados here and gangsters there and, you know, terrorists and gangsters and the idea of impunity, right? And, you know, when you look at what's happened in the United States on Wall Street and the fact that no one's really been brought to justice, and I don't think this is ideological one way or the other. I think this is just plain fact. No one's really been brought to justice for some of the incredible financial criminality that went on in recent years. I thought that might be something interesting for my characters to explore.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, we have some really larger-than-life international criminals of our own. living all along the Eastern Seaboard, and some of them living in Southern California, and it's, you know, I can see that. I can see Valentin, you know, hanging out in Brooklyn with a friend, looking at a white collar criminal on Wall Street.
It's something I'm excited about and interested in. As I said, it's a bit of a challenge for me. But you want, you know, each book is you try and challenge yourself one way or the other, and so that's what I'm working on now.
What is it they say about writing? It's you take a perfectly beautiful blank sheet of paper and create a problem that you then have to solve.
That's right. In my case, with the added inspiration or obstacle that it's usually late at night, but that's okay.
Well, Sebastian, thank you so much for your time and for creating these characters and for being with us on Speaking of Mysteries. It's really, really been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Speaking of Mysteries, next two guests will be Val McDermid and Thomas Perry, whose The Skeleton Road and A String of Beads, their novels, respectively, are also included in Amazon's list of best books of the month in mystery, thriller, and suspense for December. Until next week, this is Nancy Clare. Thank you for listening to Speaking of Mysteries.